Welcome to the Caving Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Pelser of the Central Indiana Grotto. This is a podcast about caving, which is some people call it spelunking. I'm not going to get into that. We don't call it that. We call it caving. It's about people who like to go to caves for fun or for research or for exploration. It's one of the last frontiers, really, when you think about it. And so, yeah, we have a national organization called the NSS. So if you are here and you've never been caving before, if you're curious about it or something like that, welcome. The important thing is that you know how to do it right, and because caving can be really kind of dangerous if you don't know what you're doing, if you don't have the proper equipment, and so it's like a lot of things, right? So get in touch with your local grotto. That's kind of like a local caving club, and you can find your local grotto via the NSS website, the National Speleological Society. That's our national organization. The NSS website is very easy to remember, caves.org, and you can look up your local grotto there and get in touch with people who know the caves in your area and who are willing to take you. Every grotto's got a few people that are great with beginners and are very, very welcoming. Typically, cavers are that way. And, I always like taking new people. And so you will find someone in your local grotto who will be the same. So again, caves.org. And thanks. So this podcast is sponsored by El Spelio, and right now El Spelio is, what do they got? They give it $50 off the Terra, which is one of their best lights. The Terra is an excellent light. It's the light that I use. And, right now it's $50 off. Or if you want to buy anything else from the El Spelio website, if you spend more than $300, you can get $20 off that order, that regularly priced order, by putting in the promo code podcast at checkout. Elspelio.com. They're the importers of fine lights from Europe, like the Lunatic, the Rescue, and the Terra. And again, all orders, regularly priced orders, over $300. You can save $20 by entering the promo code podcast. Or you can buy a Terra and save $50, and they sell other stuff too. Again, go to elspelio.com. I love the Terra. I don't deserve the Terra because I'm not a serious project caver, but I'm not giving it up, all right? It is a great light. It is the best light that I've ever owned, obviously. And if you're serious about upgrading your light, go to elspelio.com. And you know what? Take advantage of that sale price on the Terra. Save $50. Let's see. This month's guest is Jennifer Pinkley. She wrote the book on Fern Cave, which you can get. And we'll talk about the version of the book that you should buy. Don't go and get it on Amazon, because the version on Amazon does not have the maps and stuff in it. Obviously, that's by design. And so we talk a lot about writing the book and that whole process, and she's coming up in just a second. No caving for me this month. Nobody's really caving that much, are they? And I've been able to bank up quite a few interviews for the Caving Podcast for that very reason, because everybody's at home and everybody's available to do Skype or FaceTime or whatever. And so thanks to the folks that I've talked to in the last few weeks. It's been really, really great. Jennifer being one of them, who's quarantined at her home in Alabama. COVID-19, of course, has rocked everybody's world, and it has rocked the caving world. If you're listening to this, you probably know this already. Convention has been canceled. What a bummer that was. And then two big events near me, Spelio Fest and Karstorama, have also been canceled due to COVID-19. Huge bummer. And I'm really, really sorry for the people who have worked so hard to put those big events together. The National Convention, Spelio Fest, Karstorama. I know what it takes to put together a caving event. I was the chairman of my grotto, Central Indiana Grotto, for 2 years. And I put together two Indiana Cave Capers, which, by the way, is still on as of right now. And that is mid-August. And if that changes, I'll let you know on this podcast. I really, really hope that we can still do Indiana Cave Capers this year. But the two events that are coming up, three events in May and June have been canceled, the ones that I've mentioned. And if your event's been canceled and I didn't mention it, my apologies. Just let me know. You can email me at alpineproductions@gmail.com. But The NSS convention, Spelyofest, and Karstorama, three huge events that will unfortunately not happen this year. So I really, really hope that you can go next year and support these grottos. I know, speaking for my grotto, Indiana Cave Capers is our biggest fundraising event of the year. And I'm sure that that is probably the case for these other grottos as well. And so they'll be missing out on a lot of money, which means that those grottos won't be able to issue grants to exploration projects or things like that. So, you know, we're all having to tighten our belts because of all of this. And so I guess the thing that I could say is, if you belong to these grottos or if you have an affiliation with these grottos that will be missing out on this money, and you have deep enough pockets to make a donation, or even if you don't and you can throw, I don't know, 50, 100 bucks their way, they will really, really appreciate it. Grottos need money right now. I mean, everybody needs money. And if you're in a position where you can donate that kind of money, please do so. And speaking of donating money, this month's Karst Conservancy is Cave Conservancy of the Virginias. Every month we try to feature a different Karst Conservancy on the Caving Podcast. And Cave Conservancy of the Virginias is who we're focusing on this month, because back in March, they acquired, along with the state of Virginia, with help from the state of Virginia, Cave Hill Natural Area Preserve, which is the home of Madison's Saltpeter Cave, which is a historic cave believed to be one of the first, if not the first, cave to be mapped in the Americas. Thomas Jefferson's been there, which is pretty cool. And it's also home to an endangered species, the Madison Cave isopod. So Cave Conservancy of the Virginias, if you wish to become a member, you can visit their website, caveconservancyofvirginia.org. And there are several tiers of membership that you can how you can join up. They also have a Facebook page. But if you go to caveconservancyofvirginia.org, they can link you to that. And of course, I'll throw a link to Cave Conservancy of Virginia to the Virginias to in the description of this podcast, if you want to just click there. But yeah, they'll take your donations. They'll also take members, of course. And again, we're highlighting their acquisition of Cave Hill Natural Area Preserve. And again, they teamed up with the state of Virginia to acquire that. What a great acquisition as well. So kudos to you, Cave Conservancy of the Virginias, this month's Karst Conservancy on the Caving Podcast. All right, Jennifer Pinkley, what a great guest. Again, she wrote the book on Fern Cave. We talk about her early caving days. We talked about the days when she worked for the NSS and some of her project work, including a funny rescue story. Not a lot of funny rescue stories, because rescues are typically pretty serious and we try to take them seriously, but this was a funny rescue story. You'll want to hear this later. So here we go. Great guest. Thank you so much, Jennifer. Here we go. Jennifer Pinkley, welcome to the Caving Podcast.
Hi.
How are you?
Currently in quarantine, so
yeah, we're recording this on March the 25th. We're in the midst of coronavirus hell. And so we're doing this on a Wednesday afternoon. I decided to work from home. I hope no one from my work is listening right now. I knew I wanted to talk to you because you have the book about Fern and you have this long and storied caving life, but you were like, I'm bored. Let's do this thing. And I said, all right, great.
Nothing like talking about caving during the global pandemic quarantine.
It helps, doesn't it? I mean, it's not as good as going caving, but it helps.
Yeah, I think so.
So where did it all start for you?
So I started caving when I was 12 years old. I think it was, I don't even remember what year now, 1982 or something like that. So when I was growing up, nobody in my family liked doing anything outdoors, but I was in a Girl Scout troop. And the Girl Scout leader really loved going hiking and camping and stuff like that. And I really developed a love of the outdoors. And one year, the Girl Scout Council offered a summer caving camp. It was a whole week, and that's all you did for the whole week. And I think they had recruited a couple members of the Huntsville Grotto to lead us kids caving for an entire week. So I don't even remember why I decided that would be fun, but I did. So I recruited one of my friends in the Girl Scout troop to go, and we spent an entire week caving. And I think there were probably 12 or 13 12-year-old girls on this summer camp. And I loved it so much, I just went home and told my dad I wanted to continue going caving, and he said, okay.
A whole week. Where'd you go? Where was this?
So the Girl Scout camp was on Lake Gunnersville in North Alabama, so right in the heart of TAG.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah, and of course, you know, I didn't know what that meant at the time. And I think the first cave we went to was Guffey Cave. It's a real popular beginner trip or beginner cave kind of near Gunnersville. And we, you know, I don't even remember where all we went. I remember Guffey Cave. I remember Walnut Cave. And I remember Stevens Gap. I'm sure we went to Tumbling Rock, but I don't remember.
Oh, man. So Stevens Gap, I mean, you obviously did the walk-in, but were adults or chaperones on high alert going there?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, you have to remember this was back, what, 30, 40 years ago, and people weren't quite as paranoid about that kind of stuff. Of course,
right,
they wouldn't live near the edge or any of that kind of thing. But one of the adults did a rappelling demonstration. So he did it off the little bluff over the walk-in entrance. And so he just showed us how the gear worked and all that kind of stuff. And I do remember that and was very impressed.
What about leaders? I mean, did the Girl Scouts have to bring in special leaders who had experience and knew these caves? How did that work at that time?
So this is how I remember it. A caver named Phil Winkler, who he lives, I think, in Delaware now. He was in the Army based on Redstone Arsenal, and he was a member of the Huntsville Grotto. And somehow the Girl Scout Council contacted him. I guess he was one of the Grotto leaders at the time and asked him to help set this up. So he, from what I remember, he was working with two people who he had gotten into caving, Paul and Trish Spiliotis. And he sort of wrangled them into volunteering for a whole week to take us. So it was basically Paul and Trish. I don't remember if there were other adults. I'm sure there were. But Paul and Trish are the only ones I remember.
And
Paul and Trish are still cavers, and they live in Asheville, North Carolina now.
Ah, there we go. Shout out.
Yeah.
So did you feel the bug bite you right then and there? Like from then on, was that it? Or was it more of a slow burn into kind of getting a little more, well, let's just say obsessed?
So I actually don't really remember the first trip all that much to Guffey. I guess I wasn't like super impressed. I mean, it was fun, but it didn't like make me like super love it that first trip. But it was during that week. We went to a cave called Walnut Cave in, I think it's in Grant, Alabama. And that cave has a room pretty far back in the cave called the pool room. And you sort of have to slither up into this room. And it has a pretty sizable rimstone dam, just full of emerald green water. And there's a white dripstone formation dripping water down into this pool. And when I climbed up in that room, I can still remember it to this day. It just mesmerized me. I just remember sitting there looking at that pool thinking, this is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen, and I want to see more of this. And the trip leaders actually kind of had to drag me out of there. They're like, Jennifer, hurry up. Hurry up. We have to go. So that was the minute that I was hooked.
It's so cool to be able to pinpoint like the moment, you know, when you came across something like that and it stuck with you. Obviously, you remember it. But mm-hmm. Everybody has, every caver who's stuck with it has moments after that. And I'm looking for maybe something in the immediate aftermath, like maybe on the next few trips where it was like, yeah, all right. Yeah, I could do this.
Okay, I'll tell you about my very first Huntsville Grotto caving trip. Of course, this was, you know, I came home from the summer camp, told my dad I wanted to go caving. My dad was not an outdoorsy person. Now, keep this in mind. He, you know, was not a camper or hiker or any of that kind of stuff. But he was, you know, a good dad. And he said, sure, we'll start going. So we joined the Huntsville Grotto. And the very first cave we went to was a cave called Gross Skeleton. And it's also in North Alabama. It has two swims in this cave. The pools are probably 8 feet deep. I mean, if I went there today, I'm 5'7", the pools are over my head. So that was our first trip. Keep in mind, this is in the 80s. Nobody had Polypro. We wore jeans and a sweatshirt, you know, whatever.
Oh, no.
So we're wearing these clothes and we get to these pools. And I'm sure a lot of people listening to this podcast know who Bill Terode is. So he's on the Huntsville Grotto. He's been in the Huntsville Grotto for years and years. And he was a really active caver then. And he was on this trip. I remember getting to the first pool and a couple of the guys went in, they start swimming. And Bill Terode told my dad, you know, you just go ahead and make your way across and I'll take care of Jennifer. So I basically clung to Bill Terode's back and piggybacked across these two pools. And I was just thinking, this is awesome.
yeah, because you weren't doing
it. I don't know what my dad thought, but I thought it was pretty freaking awesome. So, yeah, I liked it.
So when you started to get into it, when I started to get into it, I knew what I liked and I thought I knew what I didn't like, but I've grown to like all of it. What did you find yourself gravitating towards and how often did you go in those early years?
Well, I think, you know, back when I was a kid, it was a little different because I didn't start doing vertical caving until I was in college. When I was younger, I liked a lot of the climbing stuff because I was really tiny and I could just climb up these walls that nobody else could get up and that kind of thing. So that was a lot of fun. And when I got into college, that's when I really got into vertical caving and I developed an interest in doing like multi-drops and things like that. I was never much of a pit bouncer. I mean, I like to go to pits and see what's at the bottom, but if I'm going to do vertical work, I started to like to do pits that led to more cave.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've talked to other cavers who have said the same thing that, you know, they like vertical if there's something down there to do.
Right. Right.
And so what came next? Like, what was the next step in getting serious about it?
Probably when I did Ellison's for the first time. I think it was, I was in college. We did it on a tag weekend one year. I went with a bunch of my Huntsville Grotto friends. That's another cave that I just remember just being blown away by how spectacular that pit is. It was just one of the most incredible things. It was an incredible thing, fantastic thing. But yeah, I was just like, wow, this is just amazing. And plus the cave at the bottom is so amazing. So that was sort of one of my first really big trips when I got really serious about vertical in college.
Yeah, that's enough to make anybody think, wow, I'm like the real deal now. I mean, I've never done it personally, but I feel like if I did, I don't know, it would give me a big ego boost. How old were you when you first did Ellison's?
19.
And I was
terrified. I was terrified of that pit. I wasn't really scared of climbing, but I was afraid of losing control on the rappel.
Yeah.
So
well,
once
you said,
I got to the bottom.
You said incredible. Was it incredible or was it fantastic that you did?
It was fantastic.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay.
But fantastic was pretty incredible.
And I'm sure you've done the through trip since, you being the longtime tag caver that you are.
Yeah. Yeah. I've done that a couple times. That's pretty amazing too.
At that point, when you had gotten to do Ellison's, were you already doing things like survey and project caving?
No, I was just sort of a sport. That's what the group of people I was caving with at the time liked to do. We would just get out the Alabama Cave Survey and sort of look at the maps and see what we thought looked interesting to visit, and we would just go. And it was maybe a year or two into college that I got into surveying.
When did you realize, I like asking tag cavers about this, but when did you come to realize that you are in one of the most special parts of the country for this sport, for this activity, and that you've got it so daggone good down there to go be able to do whatever you want and to whatever level you want? When did you come to really, really appreciate that? Because you kind of grew up around there. And so when you grow up around something, you don't really appreciate it until much later.
It was probably, you know, when I was starting to get into vertical in college, I went to the NSS convention in, was it 89 in Sewanee? It was the first Suwannee convention. I don't remember what year it was, but that was the year that I met people for the first time, really, from all over the country. And I was just used to being able to go caving after work and be like, oh, yeah, let's just drive up to Hooper's Well. It's like 15 minutes away. Just go caving for a while, go home. That's when I realized, oh, not everybody gets to do that. So.
You're so lucky. You're so lucky down there. So
I know, we were very spoiled.
What were your favorite spots for a long time before you got into survey? Because I want to talk about your survey time too.
I mean, there's just so many amazing caves. And although I say that I'm not really a pit bouncer, I mean, there are so many spectacular pits like Never Sink and Green's Well and Stevens Gap that I really love going to. And then there were other really long horizontal caves like Old Blowing Cave that's south of Huntsville. That's a really long, nice horizontal cave that the Huntsville Grotto went to a lot. Of course, Tumbling Rock, a lot of people have probably heard of that. As far as vertical, like McBride's, we have such fun multi-drop caves around here too.
What about like the very first, what I like to refer to as an ass kicker trip? Like the very first time I did a trip that was in the double digits as far as hours, I felt incredible afterward. You know, I mean, I was exhausted, but I was like, wow, I did that. You know, what was that first one that you remember and was perhaps something that really tested your limits?
I think probably it was the first time I did an Ellison's crossover trip, because it was, again, another tag weekend, and we had left early one morning. It was probably Thursday morning, drove over to the cave. And I remember getting back to the campsite at like 5 or 6 in the morning. It was a long, long trip. And I remember just, I think I slept at the campsite the whole rest of the next day. All of us who were on that trip were just like, ugh. But then another early trip that I do remember kicked my ass was to Fern Bottom Cave, because that was a really long trip at that time because there wasn't really any shortcuts that we knew about. And it was probably a 14, 15-hour trip.
Shortcuts that we knew of? I guess I'm not familiar. What's been found since then?
There have been a lot of shortcuts discovered that are just different pits that you can take to cut off significant amounts of time to get to different places. But back then, the only route to get down to the very lower section of Fern Cave was pretty long, and it took 6 hours to get down there, I guess. And then, of course, once you got down there, you wanted to look around, and then you had to come out. So it was a pretty long trip back in the 90s.
And you, of course, wrote the book on Fern Cave. When was your first trip to Fern Cave?
Probably 1990. I think that was my first trip.
What did you do on that trip?
A couple of my friends in the Huntsville Grotto had started going there and sort of finding some of the neat areas of the cave. And one of my friends had figured out the route to a famous room called Helictite Heaven. It has some really amazing formations. The thing about Fern is it's so complicated and mazy. It's multi-levels, all these canyons and stuff. It takes a long time to figure out where things are. But he had managed to find Helictite Heaven. So a bunch of us set up a trip to go. And I think it was about 6 or 7 of us. And we just went back there, looked around, took a bunch of pictures, and we had a nice sport trip.
Was it the kind of trip, though, that you would say was, I guess, inspirational for you to kind of have this love affair that you've had with Fern to the point where you've written a whole book about it? Or was it just kind of a trip that you took on a Saturday that was like a lot of others?
No, see, I had wanted to go there for a long time. When I first joined the Huntsville Grotto when I was a kid, all the older people would always talk about Fern because at that time they were still exploring and sort of finishing up the first map, things like that. So there were a lot of people going to Fern, but it was way too technical for me when I was young. And you can't really do a whole lot in that cave if you don't know how to do vertical caving. So, you know, all these people had talked about it for years, and it had been someplace I'd wanted to go for a really long time. So when I met these people who sort of knew about Fern, I sort of latched onto them and said, yeah, I really want to go. And yeah, on that first trip, I was just blown away because there are so many beautiful formations fairly close to the entrance that you can see. But then the farther you get back into the cave, it changes character so many times. Like there's all these canyons and leads and side passages and just all this climbing and crawling and more beautiful formations. It was, by the time I went to Fern, I had been to a lot of caves, but that was one of the most spectacular and complex I'd ever been to. And I remember specifically thinking when I was in one of these canyons and I was looking around and saw these leads in different places, thinking that it reminded me of the Mines of Moria in the J.R.R. Tolkien book. If you've read that, you know, the Mines of Moria was like, I think the way the author described it was vast beyond imagining or something like that. And that's sort of how I started to think about Fern.
Ah, that's it's nice to be in a place like that that reminds you of something that you've imagined before reading a book. I mean, I feel like that was my experience too. I don't know if I could pinpoint a certain reference like that, but to me, you know, going on my first few trips just felt so, I don't know, it was so transcendent and so magical. So it's nice to hear that echoed back from Caver, who has a lot more experience than I do. So when was the first time you ever did Surprise Pit in Fern?
I didn't really do Surprise for a couple years because there's really nothing to do at the bottom. I mean, if you like really, really want to push a nasty crawl, there's something down there. But it was probably another 4 or 5 years before I went to Surprise.
Yeah. And so I guess hearing your tone, is that something that you do fairly often? Do you frequent Surprise Pit?
I don't. I've actually only done Surprise twice.
Oh.
I mean, it's spectacular. I love it. But I just don't feel the urge to go back multiple times because, I don't know, like I said, there's nothing down there.
So having written the book, would you say that you've been everywhere in Fern Cave, at least that we know of?
Probably not. I've definitely been to all the major areas. I've been to a lot of really obscure areas that probably not a lot of other people have been to. But I mean, it's so big, I probably have not seen every nook and cranny. I will say that there are some areas in that cave that are really terrifying that I've gone to look at and I'm like, nope, I'm perfectly happy, never going over there. Like in one section of the cave, 1.5 million gray bats roost there in the winter. You can go to those parts of the cave when the bats aren't there, but keep in mind all those bats are in there flying around and pooping on things. And that bat guano is like icing. It makes it really slippery. And there's a lot of those canyons that are covered with guano on both sides, and they're pretty wide. And I've gone to look at some of those. I'm like, I am not going across that. So have not seen those areas.
What was then the genesis for the idea to write the book? What made you do it?
So that's kind of a funny story. Back in the 90s, one of my main caving buddies was J.V. Van Swearingen. He was a prolific cave photographer back in the 80s and 90s. We did a lot of cave trips together all over TAG, but he was the Fern Cave Access Coordinator. And that was a volunteer position created by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, who actually owns 4 of the entrances to the cave. They kind of got JV to volunteer to help them screen cavers to issue permits to go visit the cave. So he knew a lot about the cave. He knew how to find things, and he liked to go to different places in there and take photographs. So I started going with him a lot to, you know, carry his tripod or flashes and stuff like that. So I got to see a lot of the cave with him. And then, of course, got to see a lot of the photos. And it was actually with him that I first started talking about how it would be nice to write a book about it. Now, I will say that Huntsville caver named Don Myrick wrote a book about Fern Cave in the 70s. And he sort of outlined the initial mapping effort and everything the Huntsville Grotto did to explore the cave. But of course, his book ended in the 70s, so a lot happened after he was done with his book. So JV and I kind of started talking about, hey, it would really be neat to have an updated book with a lot of photos and things like that. And we started talking about that in the 90s, and then, you know, we never really did anything. But it was something that was in the back of my mind for all those years. The thing that sort of got me to kind of wanting to write a book and finish it was White Nose Syndrome. And we can talk about that in a little bit if you want. That's sort of a whole other topic with Fern.
Well, I mean, why not? Well, let's get into it. So when did you publish the book? This wasn't too terribly long ago, was it?
No, it was in 2014.
And, you're also the narrator of the audiobook version, which you can get. So White Nose, why was that what pushed you over the edge?
Just to give a little background about how Fern was managed for all these years, members of the Huntsville Grotto discovered the surprise pit entrance to Fern in 1961. Then they discovered a bunch of the other entrances in the late 1960s. At that time, they started exploring and mapping the cave, and when they were sort of done with their project, it was 15 and a half or so miles long with five entrances. During the survey project, in one of the entrances that they named the morgue, because they found a bunch of dead animals and stuff at the bottom of it, they found a bat on the wall of the cave with a band on its wing. So they managed to get that bat down and recorded the band data and sent it into, I don't think it was the Fish and Wildlife Service, it was a precursor of the Fish and Wildlife, but they sent that in and got a response from the biologist Merlin Tuttle, who is the founder of Bat Conservation International. So at that time, Merlin was actually still finishing his doctoral research on gray bat ecology, and he was super excited because it was a gray bat that he had banded, like, I don't know what state it was in, Florida or something. So he wanted to see the cave. So he came up, looked around the morgue, and discovered it was the hibernaculum for 1.5 million bats, the largest hibernaculum in the country. So because of his discovery, Merlin convinced the Fish and Wildlife Service to purchase four entrances to Fern to protect the bats. And of course, while all this was going on, the Huntsville Grotto was still exploring the cave and mapping it and that kind of thing. Bats are only in one little part of the cave. They're not in most of the cave. So Merlin said, you know, it's fine for people to keep going to all these many miles of cave that don't have any bats. All year round is fine because there's no bats there. Just keep out of the bat area. So that's when the Fish and Wildlife bought the cave. But they realized pretty quickly that they didn't know anything about the cave. They didn't know anything about the caving community. So that's when they recruited JV to help them make sure that people could still go there, but the people who went knew what they were doing, they were experienced, and they were informed about conservation, wouldn't go and bother the bats and whatnot. That worked really well. JB would screen people who wanted to go to the cave. If he didn't know who they were, wasn't really sure about their technical expertise, he would often just volunteer to take them and around. So I think that system started 1982 and continued on through the 90s up into the 2000s. And because of the collaboration between Fish and Wildlife and Huntsville Grotto, Fern was very well protected. There wasn't any vandalism. The bats were left alone. The bat colony was doing fine. So everything was going great with the cave. And that all ended in 2009 when White Nose cave closures came about. For maybe newer cavers, what happened in 2009 was White Nose Syndrome was found up in New York State in, what was it, 2007? I don't really remember what year, but as it moved farther south, it got closer to gray bat habitat. And, you know, biologists were understandably very worried about that. So in 2009, they decided to just basically close all their caves, and they closed Fern. They wouldn't let any cavers even really go on the property for a couple months because they were just really paranoid that White Nose would get into the bat population. So Fern was closed for 2.5 years. And during that period, some vandalism occurred that we didn't discover until 2011 when we went in there for a scientific project. So after this vandalism happened, I was just so mad at how the management of the cave has sort of devolved into allowing people who didn't care about conservation to go in the cave while keeping out NSS members and members of the Southeastern Cave Conservancy, that the idea of that book sort of bubbled to the surface of my mind again. I was like, you know what? This would be a great time to write a book about the amazing history of the cave, but also sort of explain to people why it needs to be protected and why other caves need to be protected. So that is a very long answer to your question.
Oh, no, I love it. I'm curious, though, how much of that made it into the book? How much of that sort of activism that you're clearly passionate about? How much of that did you write about?
Oh, yeah, it's all in there.
It's all in there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I talk about my feelings about the Fish and Wildlife because I know a lot of those people. I know that they, back then, I mean, they were really doing what they thought was right to protect the bats. But, you know, there were a lot of side effects that people didn't really consider at that time. So I thought it was important to tell people about that.
Well, I think your feelings are shared among a lot of cavers, this idea that cave closures can, in a way, hurt the cave because it keeps cavers who are concerned with conservation out of there, which would otherwise keep people who don't know what they're doing out of there because they're there to chase them away. But if nobody's there, because caving is not something that a lot of people do, and certainly not the bureaucracy of a government agency like Fish and Wildlife. I mean, they've got a lot to manage and to keep track of, and they can't be going into caves all the time. They need, I think, the caving community to be there and to populate these areas and to do so responsibly.
Right, right.
Then what else made it into the book?
Well, I'm a giant history nerd. And back when I was in college, I actually worked at the NSS office for a couple years. And when I wasn't really busy, I would sort of go down into the NSS library and poke around in the archives. And one of the things that I did when I was working there was I looked through all the old issues of the Huntsville Grotto newsletter and read all of the articles that the Grotto members in the 60s and 70s had written about Fern. And they just had some crazy stories that I just loved reading them. So the guys who, it was mostly guys, not all, but mostly, the ones who discovered the cave and did a lot of the mapping and exploration, I mean, these are people who sort of grew up during the Korean War era. A couple of them were vets, Korean War vets. You know, you couldn't go buy caving gear anywhere. You couldn't even buy, you know, caving clothes or anything. So they would wear like army helmet liners as helmets. A lot of them would either use carbide lights or they would make their own. And, you know, vertical caving was also basically in its infancy then. You couldn't go buy good rope, for example. The rope that they would use was the gold line kind of spiral type of rope. The rack hadn't been invented yet. I think one of my favorite articles was about the very first descent of Surprise Pit. Bill Cuddington was the first person to go down, and he had a rappel spool that he had gotten somebody to make him. But nobody in the Huntsville Grotto had a rappel spool. So when the Huntsville Grotto decided to rappel Surprise Pit for the first time, they used this thing called the rappel hammer. And it looks like a hammer with a T at the end. And you would clip one end into your seat harness, which, of course, back then they would just tie up webbing. And then they would take the rope and, like, wrap it around the top of the hammer. It was, like, super unsafe. But,
oh, my God.
You know, and that's the kind of, I mean, they would just do these things that, I look at some of the places that they went to without ropes and stuff. I'm like, these people were crazy. So, and, of course, the place where they rigged the pit the first couple years wasn't as sheltered from the waterfall as the current rig point. So, of course, they were getting wet. the rope might be getting a little muddy, their knots were slipping a lot of times and that kind of stuff. So yeah, I mean, they were pretty much badasses back then. I loved reading about all the exploration they did in there.
What were some other things that you saw? Were there ever any accidents in that exploration that were significant or anything like that?
No, not with the exploration. There were a couple of incidents from out-of-towners going to Surprise, like in high water and that kind of stuff. But nobody in the Huntsville Grotto that I'm aware of had any accidents in those early years.
And what about other exploration stories that just kind of jumped out at you that you felt inclined to include in the book?
Let's see. Now, one of my favorite ones was when they were first exploring, to get sort of into the middle levels of the cave, you had to go down a 155-foot pit sort of near the entrance, and you had to go through these really gnarly, tight, canyony things, and you had to do another pit that was sort of wet to get down into the middle section of the cave. It took a pretty long time because it was tight and all that kind of stuff. And as they were exploring that section of the cave, they saw this dome on the way, and they sort of climbed up, Bill Terreau climbed up and looked at it and said, well, this doesn't go. And he actually took the time to get a rock and with his carbide light, right dead end or something like that. And he propped it up so nobody would bother climbing up this section because it was kind of tricky. Well, later on when they were exploring above that section, he discovered that that dome was actually a pit that cut off like 2 hours of travel time. So just little things like that were really fun to read about. And so that's actually the main route that people still take today to get to pretty much every place in the middle lower sections of the cave.
Oh, what a great find. And so how often do you make it to Fern Cave these days?
Well, these days I don't really go very much anymore, to be honest, because all the fish and wildlife policies, I don't know, it's just not as fun anymore. I mean, we can still go there, but it's gotten so political. I don't know. I just prefer to go other places these days.
Well, I mean, that's kind of heartbreaking for me to hear, considering you wrote the book on it. I mean, do you dwell on that often, or have you kind of made peace with that fact?
Yeah, I guess I'm fine with it. I mean, I've had a really long time to go see everything I want to in the cave. What I am sad about is that the younger cavers, I mean, they can still go there, but it's just not the same as it was when I was young. It's not as open access, I guess. So,
well, let's talk about some of the projects that you've been involved with and some of the exploration that you've done. What was the very first like survey trip you were on?
That was probably a friend of mine named Rick O'Hara. He was a big surveyor back in the 90s, and he was actually doing a resurvey of a cave named Old Blowing down in Morgan County, Alabama. And so I got involved in that, and Rick actually is the one who taught me how to survey, and he taught me how to sketch, and I really enjoyed sketching, so that was something I started doing. So I got involved in that and did a good bit of work in that cave.
And so what are some highlights of your project caving career since then?
Well, I don't know that I would call it a project caving career.
Well, I mean, you know, and of course I use the word career as in like, you know, you do this and you're serious enough about it, but obviously we're not getting paid.
There's so many project cavers who have done so much more than me, but I participated in a couple of interesting projects. So again, with Rick, he found a new cave called Bloody Elbow. And so I helped with some of the surveying on that. And that cave was a freaking nightmare. It's a brand new cave, so we were excited about it, but it was horrible. It was, I have never had so much gear blow out in one trip as in that cave. I think I blew out my wetsuit and my light. And oh, it was just because it was tight and, you know, canyony and just like, blah. But so I helped on a couple trips in there.
When you do a trip like that, though, that where your gear's getting wrecked, I mean, even cavers reach a point where they're like, this is too much. Did you reach that point on that in that cave?
That was my last last trip, the one that I bought. So I was like, no, because they were just, I mean, they really, it was a pretty deep vertical cave and they really wanted to get the depth. And I wasn't feeling it. So
did you kind of put the kibosh on that and said, I'm not doing any more, or did you stick with it?
No, I didn't go again.
Gosh.
No, I didn't go again.
Well, what happened? Why was everything being shredded?
The passage we were surveying on that trip, it was just a really, really tight canyon with that sort of chert type of rock that's really sharp.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, we were just having to lay in that crap and like move around, and it was just like grabbing everything. So I was not liking it.
You've got a funny sort of pseudo rescue story.
Yeah, this was actually during the old blowing survey. So we were surveying this area where there was a lot of huge breakdown blocks. And we were trying to see if there were any leads that maybe the breakdown was hiding. And back then I was like super, super, super skinny. So I was always sent through these little tiny cracks, even though I wasn't really crazy about that idea. So we saw this pretty promising lead that I agreed to go look at it. So I left my pack at the entrance to this little lead and I kind of crawled through it. And it was a really convoluted sort of bedrock crack. And I had to do all these crazy maneuverings to get up through it. And I finally managed to get through this tight section up into a little room. So I was really excited. I was looking around. I was like calling back to my friends. Yeah, it goes. Let's see if I can find a way that y'all can fit in. And then my light went out. And I had left my pack back at the beginning of the crawl with my extra light. So I was like, damn it. So I was calling back to my friends saying, hey, my light's out. I can't figure out how to get out. Ah. And we were kind of talking back and forth. I guess the problem was the crawl had been so convoluted, I couldn't really tell how to get back down to them. So we were trying to figure out what to do. And in the meantime, unbeknownst to me, one of the guys on the trip kind of freaked out. He left the cave, got up to the surface, called his wife. His wife called the rescue squad. And the rescue squad was on the radio talking about how to get me out. In the meantime, I'm back in the crawl, like kind of trying to figure out what to do. And I had turned my light off when I realized it was dead. And finally, my light just juiced back up enough that I had a very dim light. And I managed to crawl out. It was no big deal. So anyway, that happened. I went home. It was about 10:15. I'm in bed reading and my phone rings. And my mom is on the phone and she was like, oh my God, what happened? You were on the news. I said, you're trapped in a cave. I was like, what?
Oh no.
So evidently, you know, the TV stations had picked up that rescue squad chatter. And the story that was on the news was that, I should add this too. One of my friends who was on the trip was wearing a cave suit and he was the next skinniest person. So he took his cave suit off because he thought, well, maybe I can fit up through that tiny crack. He couldn't fit, but, you know, he tried. But anyway, the story that was on the news was Jennifer Pinkley was trapped in a cave and she was freed when her male companion stripped to his underwear and managed to free her or something like that. I was just mortified. I was mortified.
So your mom found out about it on the fake news story? And
yes.
You didn't even, no one tried to call you for a comment or anything like that?
No.
Oh, man. I mean, I'm in the news business. That's bad journalism.
It was very embarrassing.
Oh, God. When was this? What year?
I don't remember. It was in the 90s sometime.
Yeah. Oh, my God. So what happened to the guy who left and called the rescue squad?
Well, I wasn't much of a yeller back then. If it had been now, I would have been, what the hell's wrong with you, man? But I don't know. I don't think I really said anything because I didn't know about it, you know, until I got home. I didn't know he had done that. So I was like,
oh, my gosh.
No, and anything about that story is evidently the people who were on the rescue squad who were coming to get me were like twice my size. So, you know, it wouldn't have helped anyway.
Yeah, they wouldn't have done any good. But that had to have been, I mean, okay, funny part aside, that had to have been kind of scary. I mean, I've never been in a situation where my light went out and I couldn't get it back on. And I was by myself. I mean, what did that do to you mentally?
Well, you know, I actually wasn't that worried about it because, like I said, this was a really popular Huntsville Grotto cave. And actually, one of my friends lived not too far from there, she probably could have fit. So, you know, worst come to worst, somebody could have called her and said, hey, come bring Jennifer a light.
Gosh. You also did some photo Sherpa-ing for...
Yeah, JV, Benson Origin. He always needed help because, of course, this was back in the film photography days. So you had to carry a camera with film, and then he always had a tripod and some external flashes. So it was always a big deal to go on photo trips with him. And JV, he took a lot of just really beautiful passage photos. He liked to capture what the passage looked like, and he also liked to photograph pits. But another thing he liked to do was take photos of women in caves and crazy outfits like dresses and, you know, stuff like that, which probably wouldn't fly in today's political environment, but it was really funny. So I helped with a lot of those photo shoots. And he actually talked me into wearing an old prom dress to Cedar Ridge Crystal Cave back in the 90s. And that was pretty funny because, so I'm wearing this prom dress. I had my Poly Pro bottoms on under the dress. And I was actually wearing my high heels. So every time he wanted to take a picture in a different location, I would have to like crawl on his back. I would hike my skirt up, but basically over my head. And he would like piggyback me to different places, take my picture. It was really funny.
Well, what are some other photos that he is known for? What did some of his other subjects get into?
Well, I didn't help on this trip, but he took a picture of two women mud wrestling in a cave, and it was on the cover of a Huntsville Grotto newsletter. And I thought it was hilarious, but some of the more conservative members of the Grotto got really pissed about it. It was a fun photo, though.
Yeah, I mean, you say it might not fly these days, but I don't know. It's all in good fun. And as long as I feel like the caving community is pretty insular and we've all got a pretty good sense of humor. We do this after all. We're all a little bit nuts.
That's so, a good point.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I've seen other stuff like what he's done. Maybe I've seen some of his work. I don't know. It's fun. What is your current caving life like? How often do you get to go?
You know, I spent my 20s and 30s caving pretty much every single weekend. But as I've gotten older, I've sort of branched out. I really like to go backpacking and hiking and stuff now. So I go caving less than I used to, but I still go at least once a month.
And is your grotto still the Huntsville Grotto?
Yeah. I'm still a member of the Huntsville Grotto, and it still has a fairly large membership and very active caving trips and things like that.
Well, I would imagine it being the location of the national headquarters. Are you involved with the national organization quite a bit?
Not at the moment. I used to be, but I have more limited volunteer time. So I was on the board of the Southeastern Cave Conservancy for about 5 years, and I'm sort of taking a volunteer break right now because that was a lot of work.
I know exactly what you mean. I was chairman of my grotto for 2 years, and it was very rewarding, but it mm-hmm. is also a big time suck. I mean, it's just a lot, and I was happy to do it, and I figured if I was doing it, I might as well give it my all, but since then, I've really kind of stepped back. I mean, I've missed the last 2 months, and obviously, I'm going to miss the next month because of coronavirus, but even though you took a step back, would you still tell people that if you have the time and if you really care about this, that you should get involved some way, either with the grotto that you belong to or with maybe your state's conservancy or your region's conservancy? And to what degree do you think people should do that?
Oh, definitely. Because, you know, when I first joined the grotto, I served in various roles. You know, I was the program chair 1 year and the secretary and the newsletter editor, and I would rotate in various volunteer roles. You know, for one thing, that's a great way to get to know other grotto members and people in other cities. And it's really rewarding to get involved in your local grotto. And my years serving on the Southeastern Cave Conservancy Board were extremely rewarding because I got to really be involved in the inner workings of buying some of the best caves in the Southeast. So, and even before, I mean, you don't have to be a board member to contribute. Before I was on the board, I helped them write a grant that got, you know, $75,000 to help purchase Fern Cave. And, you know, there's all kinds of things that people can do to help conservancies, your grottos, the regional groups. Like we have a group around here called the Sarah Karst Task Force that does cleanup trips in different watersheds. I mean, there's just so many ways to get involved. And I think it's really important for people to participate.
What are some of the things that you wish were happening in the caving world, either on the local level or the national level? I mean, membership is down and it's not in free fall, but it's continuing to go down as everyone's attentions are fragmented and as kids are spending more time indoors. What do you think the NSS should be doing?
I don't know. I think, and this might come off as a criticism, but just having been involved with the NSS for so many years, I think they try to do too much, especially now that the world is so interconnected. You know, when I first got involved in the NSS, the internet didn't exist. You had to do everything over mail. But now that, you know, it's so easy to organize different volunteer groups and different, like, cave conservancies are not super new, but they're fairly new. And I've often thought that the NSS should sort of step back from some of those things and concentrate more, maybe just outreach, forming grottos and more of that kind of stuff. And one thing I will say, and I remember this was a thing when I was in my 20s, I wanted to get involved in some of the committees. Like, I think I wanted to volunteer for the archival committee. But somebody older was selected because they had more experience. Well, I would like to see a way for a lot of the younger people to get more heavily involved, more younger people on the board, more younger people in really key positions, because, I mean, they're the future. And, you know, I'm 50. I'm not going to be doing any, you know, cool stuff in the future, but all these younger people are. And I would really like to see some of the leadership transition maybe to some of the younger people who have some innovative ideas, new ways to do things, new ways of looking at things.
Yeah, I mean, the way I got involved was I was asked. And at the time, it was a really good fit for me. I wasn't doing a whole lot. I had a lot of time. And I didn't really say anything in the meetings, but it was cool to be in the inner workings of the grotto and see how it all came together and see the amount of work that went into it. I then was given that appreciation for it. So if anyone's listening and they're trying to figure out how to pass it along to the next generation or how to make it appeal to them, just talk to them. Just ask them. Just say, hey, why don't you try this, you know, and encourage them. Because people I've found, I mean, trying to get guests for this podcast, people don't like to come forward. They don't like to come to you. They like to be asked. So ask them.
Yeah, and I will say that grottos are really good at with doing that. Like the Huntsville Grotto chair right now is, I don't know how old he is, but he is probably under 30. And he is an awesome chair. A couple of our other elected positions are people probably in their 20s or 30s. So, you know, and they're doing a fabulous job. So I kind of hope that the national organization might do something similar.
Well, Jennifer Pinkley, she is the author of Fern Cave, The Discovery, Exploration, and History of Alabama's Greatest Cave. And she's also the narrator of the audiobook. When you get done listening to this podcast and you got some extra time, maybe hit that up on Audible or wherever you get audiobooks.
Okay. I just thought of something I want to say.
Yeah.
The print book of Fern that has all the photos is not for sale on Amazon because it does have some maps in it. And I didn't want that to be available to the general public. You can get a print book from the NSS bookstore. And I think Spelio Books still has some too.
Oh, okay, great. So hit up Emily at Spelio Books and you'll be all set with the real version, the non-public version, the caver version.
That's right.
Jennifer, thank you so much for your time.
Yes. Thank you for interrupting my boring coronavirus quarantine day.
Oh, wasn't that fun? Jennifer was great to talk to, and I really hope you enjoyed it. Jennifer Pinkley, this month's guest on the Caving Podcast. And next month, we will hear from Tristan Stahl. We talked to Tristan's brother, his older brother, Elliot, on this podcast about a little over a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago. And both of them very serious cavers. And Tristan and I talked about a recent expedition that he took to he participated in New Zealand. Oh, my God. This expedition sounded incredible. And so tune in next month to hear Tristan Stahl and talking about that. And he's also, gosh, the dude's been everywhere. He lives in Denver, and he's also been on climbing expeditions to Kazakhstan and numerous caving expeditions. And he's a really young caver with a lot under his belt and a lot of plans for the future. So, I mean, I look forward to talking to Tristan again sometime on the podcast. He's got plenty to talk about, as you'll hear next month. Again, this month's Cave Conservancy is Cave Conservancy of the Virginias. Either become a member or donate at their website, which is caveconservancyofvirginia.org. And again, the link to that is in the description of this podcast if you just want to donate there or visit the website. And congratulations to them on the acquisition of Cave Hill Natural Area Preserve, home of Madison's Saltpeter Cave, which is the home of the endangered Madison Cave isopod. And thanks again to El Spilio, makers of or importers of fine caving lights from Europe. And right now the Terra is $50 off at elspilio.com. Save money on the Terra, one of their best lights. It's the light that I use, and you'll never, ever get it from me. But you can get it from them, elspilio.com, and you can click that link in our description as well. And by the way, all regularly priced orders. Again, the Terra is discounted by $50 right now. All regularly priced orders exceeding $300 save $20 by entering the promo code podcast at checkout at elspilio.com. Thanks to all the sponsors of the podcast, including Swago. Thanks for sponsoring the Caving Podcast back in the day. They were our very first sponsor. And also Organic Robot on Etsy, makers of fine caving-related apparel. Check out the Etsy shop. Charlie's a great guy, too, and he's been doing some great social media stuff as well. Again, Organic Robot, all one word. That's the Etsy shop. All right. I believe that's all I've got. If you or someone you know would like to be on the podcast, you can hit me up via email, alpineproductions@gmail.com, alpineproductions@gmail.com. Thanks for hanging in through the outro. Hope you listen to the intro as well. Stay safe. All right. This COVID-19 thing is nothing to mess with. And I'm so sorry that all these events are being canceled. What a bummer. Just stay safe. All right. I'm Matt Pelser, former chairman of the Central Indiana Grotto, proud member of the NSS, wishing you a great month. And of course, as always, kill nothing but time.